Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and a happy new year to Wayne Pacell, who has done so much, and the organizations, which we'll talk about in a second, have done so much this past year. Let's look forward to this coming year. He is, you are, the president CEO of the Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action. Happy New Year, Wayne Pacelli.
Happy New Year to you, Steve. May it be a great one for all animals. Merciful treatment for all of God's creatures.
Well, well put. And I almost don't know where to start here. So you, in 2025, helped enact, if that's the right word, legislation which would protect primates primarily and other animals as well in laboratories. How are we doing with that? And I want to hear an update also about the illegal trade of animals like macaques, which are a kind of monkey.
Yes. Well, Steve, we're in a real moment on animal testing. Historically, this was one of the really polarizing issues that animal advocates brought into the public sphere, because it often was central to some of our, you know, public health strategies to use animals, right? Drug testing, macaques are used, beagles are used, obviously mice and rats are used. Animals are used in biomedical research, or for testing chemicals and pesticides. So people would say, well, if, you know, we're going to be putting drugs into our body, or if we're going to have chemicals or pesticides in circulation, we probably want to use animals as a proxy rather than, you know, starting directly with humans. So that became a really difficult moral question to address. What we did at Animal Wellness Action and the Center for Humane Economy a couple of years ago is we worked on a bill called the FDA Modernization Act. And 75% of all animals used in testing, and we're talking millions of animals tested on annually just in the United States every year. So 75%, you're talking three-quarters of all those creatures, were used in drug screening protocols. And there was a 1938 law called the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act that regulates, you know, how we handle drugs and cosmetics and food. And in terms of the drugs, this was a requirement for every kind of drug, a cancer drug, a heart drug, a pain drug, you name all, you know, weight loss drugs, anything you can think of, all had to go through extensive multi-species animal tests. And we really crunched the data with our science team and found that in more than 90% of cases when the preclinical testing, so this is before it goes to human clinical trials, in 90% of the cases where a drug passed muster with the animal tests over many years, spending often many tens of millions of dollars, it failed 90% of the time when it went to human clinical trials. That is a terrible record of kind of, you know, forecasting or predicting the human reaction to drugs, that animals just weren't very good at giving us insights into the human condition and its the drug's effect on people. So we passed a law to eliminate that animal testing mandate, and now we're working to implement that. And we have another bill that just passed the Senate in December, and it should pass later this January or in February in the House, and it'll be signed into law. And coincident with that, or really kind of a derivative of that, the United States public health agencies, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, are all embracing these new methods, human biology-based methods like organs on a chip or organoids or AI, rather than just relying exclusively on animals. So, Steve, it's a process, right? We're not going to flip a switch, and we're not going to get rid of animals overnight, but we are moving very, very rapidly toward a future that's much more reliable in terms of judging the safety of drugs, the efficacy of drugs, and it's not going to involve nearly as many animals, and it's going to involve these new 21st century strategies.
And you do amazing work to make that happen. Do you find that, okay, here's something, finally, that really is bipartisan?
I think so. I mean, we all care about public health. This is not just an animal protection issue. You know, how many politicians talk about high drug prices, right? I mean, this tied into our health care system. It costs, Steve, $2.2 billion from a drug to go from concept to marketplace. And when you're talking about 90% of those drugs that start off then failing when they go to human clinical trials, you're talking about, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion is squandered. That means that our drug development system, it's so expensive that the pharmaceutical companies are really going to go after the biggest drugs with the biggest market potential, right? So an Alzheimer's drug or, you know, a heart drug, a weight loss drug. But we have 7,000 diseases that afflict human beings. What about all the research and testing of drugs to have cures or palliative treatments? This drug development system is broken because the R&D side is so expensive. And I feel, Steve, like this is really one of the issues that is another example that when we're good to animals, we have better outcomes for the whole society.
Yes, and if you could explain that to some people running for office, because they will agree because they're human beings, this makes perfect sense. But above and beyond that, it's an economic issue, as you point out, which you wouldn't think about until it is pointed out to you. So there I was, Wayne Pacelli of the Center for a Humane Economy, Animal Wellness Action. I was at the theater, and it was opening night at the theater. And we're walking, my wife and I are outside, and we're leaving, and there's a TV personality. I don't know her, but I've seen her on TV, and I know who she is, and she might know who I am. And I would have said hello, but there was a problem. She was wearing, and my wife confirmed this because I wouldn't know, but my wife knows. I said, "Is that real fur?" And she said, "Yes." She was wearing a fur coat. And you know what? In the 1980s, maybe, certainly in the 1960s, it was cool and avant-garde if you wore fur. That's no longer the case. And you are doing something to support us having fewer, if any, mink farms.
I am, Steve, because we don't need, as you say, this product any longer. We don't need the fur of mink or other animals like bobcats. I mean, we have alternatives. I mean, we have all sorts of fabrics. We can make a product that looks exactly like a fur coat, has great functionality, and doesn't come from killing 40 mink or 20 bobcats to make a single coat. So I've been working on this issue, as you know, a long time, and you, Steve, have been working on this issue, and so many other people who care about animals. Most of the major fashion houses are no longer working with fur. Most of the major coat retailers aren't selling fur any longer. It's very rare to find people buying fur coats in America any longer. But we still do have some mink farms. These are factory farms for mink where you have hundreds or thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of mink in a shed.
Now, I want to stop you because we have to take a break here. But what people might not understand, this is more about fashion. It's actually about public health. I'll have you explain that when we come back, in addition to talking about what you're doing about dog fighting. And one might think, well, they've done everything. It's illegal. It's a felony. Well, the people have found ways around it. And we'll talk about that when we come back with Wayne Pacelli on WGN. Wayne Pacelli is the president and CEO for a Center for a Humane Economy and Animal Wellness Action. AnimalWellnessAction.org if you want to learn more. And we'll talk more about these organizations in a few minutes. And we were talking about furs. And, Wayne, it was kind of a cool thing and very avant-garde. If you wore a fur in the 1930s to the 1960s, and you were considered very upper crust if you did it, and a lot of performers did it when they went to those red carpet openings and all the rest, but became out of fashion. And ethical reasons are the most often discussed reason for this, and I understand that, and you can talk about that, but it's more than we now know today, more than simply the ethical issue of let's do right by the animals. It turns out to be let's do right by us. Can you explain what I'm talking about?
Yes, Steve, during the COVID-19 crisis, what was amazing is that, you know, millions of people, you know, were infected with the virus, hundreds of millions of people, and a lot of people died. there was a parallel outbreak on mink farms of the COVID-19 virus. Turns out that there was no other non-human species in the world that was more vulnerable to COVID-19. So when mink farmers would, you know, tend to their animals and they got sick, they passed on to the mink. There were thousands of mink at some of these farms. The virus would course through the population. It would mutate. And the concern was that the virus would mutate so much that our vaccines against COVID-19 wouldn't work. And also that the disease as it mutated would become even more virulent. You know, the mortality rate for people who contracted COVID-19 was not particularly high. It affected elderly people. They were much more vulnerable than young people. But if the virus became more virulent and, you know, rather than 1% of people dying, it became 30%, that would change the world as we know it. So it turns out that mink are very vulnerable to all sorts of viruses. And when we introduce one of these viruses from people into a mink farm and it courses through the population and gets spit back out to people, we are threatening to have the next pandemic. So why would we take such public health risks for a gratuitous and unneeded product like a fur coat? And I think that's the question that we're really presenting to federal lawmakers. Why are we tolerating these mink farms? Their whole purpose is questionable. And now when you add in the zoonotic disease risk, it makes no sense. They're time bombs in our communities.
Well, indeed, everything you said is true. And mink and their relatives in the mustelid family are particularly susceptible to coronaviruses, particularly what is novel to them, as this virus was. But you're right. I mean, totally correct that the concern is that as the virus spreads in the mink population, it would likely mutate. And then who knows what we have that would impact us. And Europe has stood up to do something about it, most recently Poland, but other countries during the pandemic, first of all, culled, nice word for killed, millions of mink. And many of those countries have either decreased or altogether banned mink farming, not only for the ethical reasons of mink, but really because of a concern for public health.
And that's why those bans have been imposed. Now more than 20 countries in Europe and the EU, I mean, countries that had big fur farming industries like the Netherlands. You just mentioned Poland. Poland's the biggest producer, 6 million mink a year being harvested, as they say, from these fur farms. Of course, the ethics were top of mind. But when you think about, you know, millions of people potentially dying from the next pandemic, why would you take that risk for a silly little mink coat when we can have other clothing to keep us warm and stylish?
All right. So where are we legislatively, or where are you with this legislatively in the United States?
Well, a couple of years ago, we passed the mink farming ban in the House, but it stalled in the Senate. We worked with Vern Buchanan, a Republican of Florida, and Rosa DeLauro, a very senior Democrat in the House from Connecticut, on the new legislation. So it was just reintroduced. We're going to, you know, give it, you know, supercharging, and we want to get this done because it's a horror show for the mink and it's a viral threat to the world. And why are we doing this, selling these mink coats to the Chinese, but we have in our homeland a zoonotic disease threat incubating right in our communities? Makes no sense.
All right. Now, there's another question because you mentioned the Chinese. So what the Chinese have done is Europe has minimized or outlawed, banned in many countries, these mink farms. China has kind of stepped in. Now, the good news is there is less demand for mink from the public than there's ever been. But having said that, are you concerned? Because viruses don't care what country they begin in. So are you concerned that, okay, even if we ended this in the U.S. for all the reasons you mentioned and more, that, okay, as long as, and even if Europe stops it altogether and they're close, mm-hmm. then are you concerned about what China will continue to do?
I am. I mean, look, SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19 started in China, you know, probably from a live wild animal market. And, it didn't take very long for that virus then to spread around the world, and it got to the United States. So these are global pandemics, and with our global transportation systems, with people flying from Beijing to New York every single day, it doesn't take long for a virus to move all the way across the world. So, yes, I'm concerned, but we're going to have more moral authority to ask the Chinese to step up if we ourselves step up. This is a completely inconsequential industry from an economic perspective to the United States. The gross sales of mink pelts last year were $28 million. They probably cost $35 million to raise those minks. So they're losing money. We're losing 10 to 15% of all mink farms every year. For what reason are we taking this risk? It makes no sense to me.
Absolutely. So we have, as you and I talk, typically we end up at this place where I say, we only have less than a minute left. So unfair to say to you, we have, because I want you to talk about the FIGHT Act and what we can do to help fight to support this in that time.
This is an upgrade of our national animal fighting law. Even though, as you said at the beginning of the broadcast, Steve, animal fighting is illegal everywhere. I've been working on that. You've been working on that for years. It is outlawed, but we have an amazingly stubborn animal fighting industry in the U.S. We may have 20 million fighting birds. We have thousands of backyard dog fighting networks. We're upgrading the law to really dismantle these networks. We should have zero tolerance for staged animal fighting in the United States. So we want people to write to their U.S. senators and representatives in support of the FIGHT Act.
Yep, spelled just like it sounds, the FIGHT Act, animalwellnessaction.org. It is all about the action that this organization is taking. But, Wayne, I suspect you agree, it helps when people also reach out to their public officials as well.
No, this is a movement, Steve. We have to have collective action to change these big problems in our society. Animal fighting is a problem. Mink farming is a problem. Factory farming is a problem. Puppy mills are a problem. You can't win these battles with just good sentiment alone. We have to all get involved and help. So we invite people to join us.
All right, animalwellnessaction.org. I happen to know there's a newsletter that you can sign up for as well, animalwellnessaction.org. Wayne Pacelli, always good to talk to you. So what do Tom Brady, that's the six-time Super Bowl winning quarterback and current Fox Sports broadcaster, have in common with Barbara Streisand? Well, they do have something in common. Brady made an announcement that he is an investor in a company called Colossal Biosciences that also acquired an animal cloning firm called Viagen Pets and Equine. And Brady also has cloned his dog. His dog, Junie, is a clone of his late dog, Lua. And he's very excited about that. Lua is a pit bull mix that Brady and his ex-wife Giselle Bundchen adopted and died about a year after the couple divorced. And he thought, you know what? I want the same dog. And he cloned the dog. Barbara Streisand, well, she cloned a dog as well. Very famously in 2018, when people just weren't doing that, Barbara Streisand brought widespread attention to animal cloning, and she revealed that she had cloned her beloved Coton de Tulear, a very fancy breed, of course, named Samantha, resulting in two dogs, Miss Violet and Miss Scarlet. Streisand said she wanted to keep a part of Samantha alive. Streisand then said, well, I was kind of disappointed. Those are my words, not hers, but that's the essence of what she said, because the animals that were cloned from the original, Miss Violet and Miss Scarlet, weren't at all like her dog that she had cloned, the dog that passed away, Samantha. And in fact, that's likely to be the case. So did you know that a dog that is cloned or any other animal may not even look like the original? So if you clone a Coton de Tulear, the very fancy breed, you will get a Coton de Tulear, but not necessarily the same color and not necessarily the same size. And also all animals eat differently, so that impacts how much the animal weighs as well. Big thing is personality. Personality, yes, it's based on genetics, but it's also based on life experience. And there is no way, no how, that another animal born years later can have the identical life experiences as the original. That's impossible to happen. So here's my question to all of you. If it were free, the price is about $25,000 to $50,000, $25,000 for cats, up to $50,000 or more for a dog. But if it were free and there were no price tag involved, would you clone a pet? My answer is no. I want to remember the original for what he or she was, knowing that the cloned animal isn't going to be the same anyway. Steve Dale back with you on WGN and from Heal Veterinary on Rockwell Street near the Chicago River on the north side of Chicago. It is a very old friend of mine who I've not had on the radio in way too long, Dr. Derek Landini. Hello, Dr. Landini.
Hey, Steve. How you been?
Great. You and I go back a long ways. And over the years, I've had you on the radio here and there. But personally, I call you a friend, and I thank you for everything you have done for our companion animals. You're simply one of the best we have in Chicago.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, Steve.
Well, it's true. You know what? Veterinarians, do you think, and then I want to talk about cold weather and pets and keeping our pets safe, but do you think, you've been practicing for some time now, that veterinary medicine has changed and also the public perception toward veterinarians has changed? And if so, how?
Oh, a huge paradigm shift. I mean, we're starting to see pets show up in areas where we've never seen before. They're in restaurants and they're making specific dog parks now just for pets and clothes. And they're becoming more a member of a family. Even though when I graduated, and I won't even say how long ago, they were always members of my family. You and I are probably ahead of the times, but now they are becoming lots of members of families. And four-legged kids are a lot cheaper than the two-legged kids. No offense, my sons, but they are.
Yeah, they are. So well, that's something people forget about. So the same treatment with the same equipment, the same training, and let's say it's something as serious as cancer, right? So that, without, if you don't have pet insurance, that will cost you X amount of dollars for, say, surgery, depends on what kind of cancer it is, the protocol following the cancer of the cancer drugs may be the same chemotherapy that are given to people, just less of it because pets are smaller, and also the same sort of process through recovery and the same training, the same exact identical equipment to do everything. And yes, it might be what I'm describing. I don't know. You tell me $7,500 or even more. However, and that's a lot of money. I get it. However, for a human being, for the same procedures, same surgery, same cancer, and same drugs to treat it, we're talking probably $100,000 or $200,000. Am I right about that?
I think that's very fair to say that in comparison, the veterinary medicine definitely is more economical compared to human medicine. What would you say, challenge anybody to say differently?
Yeah, and I understand where the complaints come in. However, your costs have gone up too as a owner of a private practice, and your employees, then their costs go up. The equipment that you have, the drugs you pay, all those things have gone up, and that's one of the reasons. But on the other hand, I'm not defending it because it's getting more and more difficult to afford anything, to some extent, including veterinary care, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. And another reason, too, is I think people want, they expect more out of us. I mean, they don't expect just us to give the shot and hope that the patient gets better. I think they want us to get an answer. And sometimes answers cost money, more diagnostics, and what would you say, more advanced imaging, for example, like CT scans, MRIs, those weren't available back when I was first out of school unless you drove down to the university. Now they're available in order to have those readily available in Chicago. It's definitely going to cost more.
And the cool thing regarding your practice is you can do many of those things today, 2026, I think we're at now, in-house. as compared to some not all that long ago where you'd have to go to either a specialty clinic or the veterinary school, even in Champaign or up in Madison.
Correct. Yeah, we try to practice high quality medicine as best we can. There are some things that we will refer to our specialists when it comes to that point. But you know, being in practice for over 30 years, I had to makeshift my specialty back in the day when we didn't have them down the block from us. So. Yeah. It makes it challenging sometimes to treat our patient with the utmost care, at the same time knowing that there's a specialist out there, too, that's very helpful.
Yes, indeed. Oh, okay. So what we're really here to talk about, and it's just so nice to talk to you personally, but what we're here to talk about is cold weather. So are you going outside today, a cold day in Chicago, without a sweater, without a coat, without a jacket on, Dr. Landini? Do our pets need it? Or is this just like, we shouldn't be spending the money on this, it's just fashion first? Is it beneficial for our pets?
Well, absolutely. And you know as well as I do, the breed that I have, my little baby, Francois, wouldn't even think about going outside without a jacket on. And since he's a hairless breed, a Chinese Crescent, for example.
Well, I need to stop you with all due respect. Let's be politically correct here. Follically impaired. How's that?
Yes. I apologize to those dogs that have genetic alopecia, I guess you would say.
And those dogs actually, your point is that those dogs actually need or require when it's cold outside. How cold, you know, let's talk about all toy dogs, the really small ones. How is there a magic number that you have in mind where, okay, if it's below a certain temperature, that dog should wear a coat or jacket?
Yeah, I think, you know, 45 degrees Fahrenheit or 7 degrees Celsius, it's a caution for the small dogs, the puppies, even the old dogs. Or dogs with a thin or short hair coat, they can become uncomfortable if they're out for longer periods of time.
You know, that's something that's often overlooked. So just like older people do tend to get cold more easily, I want to make a point of what you just said. The same is true for dogs. So even if you have a geriatric Malamute, they're an Arctic breed. They were bred to enjoy weather that's 20 degrees. If you're lucky enough to have a Malamute that makes it to, say, 14, 15 years of age, is that dog even going to have a tougher time, never mind all of the smaller dogs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it becomes unsafe as it gets down to freezing, 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Then you even have to be even more conscientious of these little toy breeds and small puppies and older patients, I should say.
What about sighthounds?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have much fat on them, do they?
No. So, I'm jealous.
No kidding. Ozempic automatically for those dogs, I guess. Think about it.
So those dogs. But on the other hand, I'd argue that a young, in shape, Great Pyrenees or St. Bernard or Bernese Mountain Dog would enjoy and does enjoy the weather, but the question when we come back from this break is, how do you know when enough is enough? I want to talk about wind chill in dogs. Do they feel it? Do dogs get frostbite? We'll talk about all of that and the big question, booties or no booties? All when we come back with Dr. Derek Landini on WGN. From Heal Veterinary Clinic in Chicago, it is Dr. Derek Landini. So I promised to talk about this. Your Labrador Retriever is just having a great time chasing that tennis ball and somehow finding it in the snow. And let's say it's like today, it's cold outside. Then what do you do? At what point in time do you say enough is enough? Because I would argue some labs and many other dogs would go, they're having a great time. They'll go on and on and on. Or do we let them go on and on and wait until they show signs of being cold?
No, I don't think we wait. I think we need to be conscientious of, you know, how long they've been out there. And obviously all dogs aren't the same, but some dogs are more prone to the cold, unlike other dogs.
Do dogs get frostbite? Or people have indoor outdoor cats. Do cats get frostbite?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the magic number that I've learned in school is if anything's below 20 degrees, or not below 20, if 20 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 7 degrees Celsius, it's dangerous for dogs and people at that point. And usually we'll see frostbite affect, you know, the extremities, right? Just like our hands and feet. With dogs, they have ears, and they'll get affected, the paws, the tail, the nose, and that can happen within minutes.
So do you want to get rich creating a glove for dog tails so they don't get frostbite?
Hey, you know what? I think there's probably already one out there, if I had to take a guess.
But what are the signs that it is too cold or that dog may be getting frostbite? Are there things that either we should look for, and then if we find, what do we do about that? I know you don't throw the dog into a hot bathtub, for example.
No, not at all. So some of the signs we see with cold stress would be like they're refusing to walk or lifting their paws, pale, painful extremities. Even this simple tremoring or shivering, you know the dog's cold at that point, too.
So tell me about antifreeze.
Oof. Antifreeze, the problem with, well, it's more common, obviously, in the wintertime, also known as ethylene glycol. Very toxic to our animals, especially even in small amounts. The problem, it attracts pets. It tastes sweet. So, you know, you think they wouldn't drink it, but they would. It tastes yummy to them, and it can cause acute kidney failure, and that's not a good thing. And sometimes these dogs will get into it, or even cats, and you don't know they got into it, and now they're showing clinical signs of not eating, vomiting, diarrhea. That's definitely a concern.
And it must be frustrating to you because you must think, I'm treating this animal, I've got to figure out what I'm treating for, and then maybe you figure that out. As you said, often you don't know that they got into this, and
right,
that dog or cat may die as a result. Have animals died that you've seen as a result of antifreeze? Because it does, I believe it takes just a little bit.
Yeah, back in the day we did. Now there's a test, actually, a urine test that we can do to detect it. So if you think your dog may have gotten into it, you can always just contact your veterinarian, and they can run that test to see if there has been exposure.
And nowadays there is also pet-friendly antifreeze, which I suspect you are a supporter of. You said the antifreeze tastes sweet. It does. But this has a bittering agent in it, so it's not as attractive for pets. It's still not a good thing for them to drink, but it's not as deadly, and they're not as likely to do it.
Yeah, you wish they were all pet-friendly, but I'm not sure why they're not.
Yeah, I don't know either. That's a good question. I've got a good question for you. I know it's a dramatic question and highly controversial, Dr. Landini. Boots or no booties?
Well, I personally prefer the booties, but my dog doesn't like them. He just keeps shaking them off. I see a lot of dogs really tolerate them well. I've tried many different booty products out there for my guy, but he just rather just go outside and do his business and come right back in without the booties. But I tried the booties. My guy just doesn't want them.
What about alternatives? One I know is a product called Musher's Secret. It's available online in lots of pet stores. It's like sort of a waxy protection, if you will. So the salt is supposed to come right off. Or using unflavored Pam or another brand name, it doesn't matter, cooking spray.
Yeah, I've heard of that before, yeah. And there's another one like Tomlin makes, a Protecta Pad, where it's kind of a waxy type material that's put on the feet. I don't know if that'll keep them warm, but it'll actually protect their feet from the irritation from any salt or ice getting stuck between their feet. You always want to check their feet when they come in anyway to make sure that there's nothing stuck between their toes that's going to cause more harm than good. I'll wipe his feet all the time, too. And then there, of course, the salt that you want to use, at least we use around our clinic and at my house, I'll use that pet-friendly, safe salt.
exactly what I was going to ask you next. So now I won't. But there, you know, the good thing, I mean, when you began practicing, those salts weren't available. And then somewhere along the way they were, but they were way more expensive. I find, at least in my experience, they're still a bit more money than conventional salt, but not much more.
No, yeah, I think it's definitely reasonable. I mean, because other stuff can cause the paws to get irritated and burn. And then even some dogs, when they lick their feet, they're ingesting the salt, and it can cause a tummy upset.
Were you a fan back in the day of Tony Orlando and Dawn? Do you remember them?
No, I don't.
Oh, no. So the song, one of their hit songs was Knock Three Times. Knock Three Times.
Okay.
You don't
know. Now you're refreshing my memory. Sure.
Barely, yeah. Probably. So my new song is Knock Three Times on the Car Hood in the Morning. I'm thinking about the cats that slink under the car hood. It's kind of an electric blanket to them.
Yeah, those engines can definitely get warm, and then those cats will like to warm up underneath the hood. And I know people will beep the horn or knock. That's always a good idea. I mean, if you're parked in a garage, you're probably safe that that's not going to happen. I mean, like a closed garage, not like a parking garage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's definitely something that we've seen some injured cats come into the emergency clinic when I worked in the ER back in the day with their tails degloved and sometimes lethal wounds when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. So prevention is always a good idea, and it's probably not your cat. It's someone, a neighbor, somebody's indoor-outdoor cat, or maybe just an outdoor-only cat, a so-called feral cat, and a community cat's a better way to put it. But that cat finds warmth under the hood, and they're looking. Cats are really good at finding warm places. They're not always safe places, is the thing.
Yeah, we have community cats in our neighborhood, too. So they're always working 24/7 in the Chicago area.
Well, the good thing is we have less vermin wherever those cats are, and that's good news. The other good news, Dr. Landini, I got to talk to you. We're out of time, unfortunately. I wish we had more of it, but it's always good to talk to you, and a belated Happy New Year. A young seal walks into a bar. The bartender says, "What do you have?" The seal replies, "Anything except a Canadian club." Funny? Not really. Why do I bring this up? It's because in Richmond, New Zealand, that is exactly what happened. The bartender didn't ask the first seal who walked into the bar, "What do you want to have to drink?" I don't believe. And certainly the first seal didn't reply. But it really happened. A fur seal randomly walks into a bar, maybe to warm up. I don't quite know why. Eventually, the seal was kind of pushed, if you will, gently into the bathroom where officials came out from the Department of Conservation to relocate the fur seal. Another thing happened. Blossom. Blossom is so tall that she can step over the moon without jumping over it. Blossom set the Guinness Book of World Records for the world's tallest cow at 6 feet 4 inches. Thought you'd want to know. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.